The Business of Exhibitions. I'm Clarissa Levy, Art and Heritage Council at Wedlake Bell.
And I'm Richard Harwood, I'm a barrister at 39 Essex Chambers.
And I'm Anthony Mosquita. I'm a solicitor at the General Counsel of the Victoria and Albert Museum and a consultant solicitor at Keystone Law.
Well, welcome, Anthony, and thank you so much for joining us this morning. We're very excited to speak to you. We are full of questions because you are the V&A's only in-house lawyer. And as I understand it, most of your work for the museum is exhibition related. So I am full of questions this morning about exhibitions. When we discussed this, you explained that exhibitions are creatures of business, which was a surprise. So can you tell us about that?
Yes. I think the point that I try to get across to people is that this applies at the V&A, but I don't think I'm speaking out of turn by saying this is the business model for all of the big museums, certainly London, and even outside of London, the bigger museums, is that we have a business model. We have an ecosystem that is built around our exhibition program. We've all got magnificent permanent collections and magnificent galleries. And that's great. Tourists come and love our galleries. The British public love our galleries. But how do we get people back again and again, two or three times a year? Well, we do that through our exhibition programs. So exhibition programs drive everything. They drive visitors. They drive income. They drive publicity. So everything that we do as a museum is, not everything, of course, but a large focus of what we do is built around our exhibition program. And certainly my work, I never appreciated this when I started this role 9 years ago, is that 50, 60, probably some weeks, 90% of what I'm doing is around our exhibition program.
And when thinking about your work, if you had to summarize what your role is in terms of what you do around the exhibitions, how would you do that? What would you say your focus is?
So right at the beginning, if you look at this as a circular diagram with different zones, like an onion, right in the middle, I get involved very early on. Let's imagine we're having a big blockbuster fashion exhibition. We have to engage with the brand very early, 3-4 years in advance. And I'm very much at the heart of that. So those negotiations with Chanel or Dior, whoever it is, I sit there often like the spider in the web, because there's a big contract and the contract has to sort of, there's elements of development, there's elements of retail, publishing. So one overarching contract. I try and do one overarching contract when I can, but often we end up with 3 or 4 different contracts. So that's the contract. And once we've got that nailed down, then we sort of move out into the next circle. And the next circle will be things like sponsorship. Sometimes the brand will be the lead sponsor as well, but often not. So often then we have a big sponsorship contract, which can be as complicated as the exhibition contract, particularly things like where you've got benefits in kind. So when we have our big interactive exhibitions, when it's a Pink Floyd or a David Bowie or we did an exhibition on 60s counterculture, it doesn't work unless you've got state-of-the-art audio. So Sennheiser provided our state-of-the-art audio. They gave us £1 million worth of audio equipment and maintained it and replaced it throughout the exhibition and the tour. And we didn't pay for that. But it was what we call in-kind sponsorship, which sounds great, but actually the finance department always roll their eyes when we talk about how great it is, because from a VAT perspective, it's nightmarish. You have to cross invoice because we provide a benefit, they provide a benefit. We have to have cross invoices for VAT purposes.
Always about tax.
It's always tax. Sometimes those sponsorship contracts can be incredibly complicated. We did one with Levi's, which had all sorts of sort of things that they did for us, and because it's not gone are the days when the sponsor just throws us a couple of £100,000 and we stick their name above the door. Now it's a complex collaboration.
Is it a sense that you're relying in some cases on equipment and staff and facilities from the sponsor? It's not just them paying you, but also the sponsor has got a brand to look after and how that's managed and how that's presented.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, the way that traditionally, what we like to do is exhibitions are very expensive. A V&A exhibition, the capital costs are in the millions. So what we try and do as much as we can is get that money in from a sponsor to fund the capital costs. So that's why we're doing it. At the same time, the sponsor has to identify the synergies and has to get their deal. And what we like is we like it when our sponsors come back again and again. Sometimes it's relatively straightforward. You have a big fashion exhibition and the banks want that. They want to reflect in the glory of a Chanel or a Dior. But other times, I mean, I often talk about this exhibition. The exhibition we had was in 2016 was called You Say You Want a Revolution, which is a Beatles lyric. And it was about that period in the late 60s, early 70s, when there were all sorts of revolutions going on. There was, of course, there was music. There was Woodstock. There was Sgt. Pepper. But then you had civil rights movement. You had a sexual revolution. You had all sorts of gender issues going on. You had, in every sphere, it was seismic. Fashion, design, computers. It was a really rich period, a strangely rich period for creativity. So we looked at that through the lens of V&A Collection. And then when the sponsors came along, they took quite a sophisticated look at it. So for example, Sennheiser looked at this and they said, okay, this audience are going to be audiophiles. They're also going to be, can have a bit of money in their back pocket. So they actually identified that the audience for that exhibition was the exact correct demographic for £300 noise-cancelling headphones. So they were quite happy to put money into our exhibition, because what other opportunity have they got to put their kit on the ears of 300,000 people over a short period of time?
So my question is always, how does, taking a step back, how do exhibitions come about? There must be infinite possibilities as to what exhibitions you could offer. So why does one idea win over another idea? And how can you tell what's going to be successful and what's not?
Point number one, nothing to do with me. I come in, I help, but I don't have any decision-making, which is a shame. I'd love to be involved in some of those discussions. They come about in a couple of ways. Sometimes the big ones, the Diors and the Chanels, that's a smoky room over a wonderful meal in Paris and a handshake at the end of it, and 3 years later it happens. But oftentimes it's, more often than that, what happens is they come up from the curatorial teams. So there's various committees. So what happens is the curators pitch ideas. And if those ideas get the thumbs up, they work through a system. You get an initial thumbs up and then they go away and they come back with a worked up proposal. And at some point it gets the green light. And then you get a budget. Then you get a time. Then you get a slot in the exhibition program and you work to that. But actually, it's a complicated collaboration, because right from day one, you've got to collaborate with development. So the development department in the museum is they're the people that bring the money in, so donations and sponsorship. So they're involved the day before day one. Very early, you have to get development involved to find the right sponsors. You have to get commercial involved for the retail. You have to get publishing involved. You have to get the learning department involved, because they need to build a credible learning program. And so at every part of the events, the corporate events, when we've got a big blockbuster on, our corporate events business does fantastically well, because everybody wants to have their summer party or their Christmas party in amongst those galleries. And it does all feed into whether or not an exhibition gets the green light. So the curators are very good at saying this exhibition on whatever it is has got the potential to be fantastic for retail for these reasons, fantastic for events for these reasons, fantastic for learning for these reasons. So that's how you pitch the exhibition.
And so telling in advance whether something's going to be a big smash hit or whether it's just going to be quite quiet, have you had many surprises?
Yes. So some surprises in a good direction and some surprises in a bad direction. It's a difficult. Sometimes we know it's going to work. So when you get a big brand, when you get your, I keep saying Chanel and Dior, because those are the two most recent really big brand-based exhibitions we've had, which have done very well critically in terms of visitor numbers and financially. So we knew that they would. Other ones, we do take a punt, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So, and often it's a strange sort of timing thing. So we had an exhibition on Frida Kahlo in 2018, and we got the timing absolutely right, because 2 or 3 years earlier, people knew Frida Kahlo, but certainly 5 years earlier, she was known as the partner of Diego Rivera. But almost the minute we decided we were going to do an exhibition on her, all these sorts of things started happening in the background. And she was sort of reclaimed as one of the great South American artists of recent times. So by the time we opened our exhibition, we just got the zeitgeist. We hit that zeitgeist right on the nose, even to the extent, and this has nothing to do with us, that in the months leading up to it, Theresa May was wearing Frida Kahlo earrings.
Well, we can't get sexier than that.
We've got the Prime Minister doing it. So.
Exactly, doing our marketing for us. It was wonderful. So that was a huge success. The Mexicana that we had in our gift shop, we just couldn't stack the shelves quickly enough. Whereas other exhibitions, we had great hopes for some exhibitions and they don't quite work. So we had an exhibition on opera, which didn't work that well, certainly financially. I mean, the amount of work goes into these things and as an intellectual exercise, and often in terms of the critical response, they tend to do well. But in terms of getting people in the door, some of them don't. So Ocean Liners, for example, didn't succeed. But then there's some, so we have free exhibitions and some of those are magnificently well received. So we had a wonderful exhibition on plywood.
Gosh.
I'm interested in this.
It was what I know about plywood I learned from that exhibition, but even I could wax lyrical about plywood now for a good 10 minutes. It's a wonderful material and kind of world-changing. Without you don't realize it. You don't realize how significant plywood is until you see an exhibition on it. For example, there wouldn't have been an Art Deco movement. You wouldn't be able to have those curves in your furniture without plywood.
It is quietly very exciting. I completely see why that would have been a total hit. So you're supposed to be educating and putting out new design ideas out there? Or is there a tension between that side of things and also the need to make this into a financially kind of lucrative business?
Yes to all of those questions. But if you look at the National Heritage Act, our objects are to educate people about art and design through our collection and other means. So it is about educating people on those, on art and design. Since we took over the Theatre Museum, we've expanded into performance as well. So that's how we can bring in David Bowie and Pink Floyd and Taylor Swift.
Taylor Swift, we'll come on to Taylor.
So educating people about art, design and performance. And people often say to us, if you could get away with it, you would do Dior, then you do Chanel, then you do Alexander McQueen again, and then you do Gucci, wouldn't you? And actually the answer is, I don't think we would. I think we would want to do that because that would be boring. So we do mix it up. So if you look at what we've got on at the moment at the V&A, we've got Naomi Campbell, which is pretty much a fashion exhibition. We've got Elton John and David Furnish's photography collection. Now that's got this, it does have a celebrity element to it, but actually what we're talking about here is a stellar photographic collection, one of the greatest photographic collections in the world, and Tropical Modernism, which looks at sort of post-colonial architecture in parts of Africa and India. So Tropical Modernism is never going to be a blockbuster like a Chanel or even a Frida Kahlo, but it's essential that we do something like that. And actually the museum would go up, if an edict came down from the top that from now on, we're not going to do exhibitions like that. We're just going to have big name exhibitions. It's going to bring in the big bucks. I don't think there'd be any staff left because I think that we all see the need to have a broad program covering off all sorts of different things.
And so another big part of your work, which I think is very interesting, when you think about exhibitions from the perspective of the business angle, is risk. So it must be about minimizing risk. And what are the risks? What goes wrong with exhibitions?
Oh, crikey.
That's an awkward question.
I think Richard might have a view on this. We were sharing some stories earlier in the day about what could go wrong.
Well, I think the one horror story, I think, is always the Wookiee Hole Children's Museum, if you had a teddy bear exhibition, including Elvis Presley's teddy bear. It was called Mabel. And the insurers were particularly sort of cautious about it, so insisted on 24-hour security with a guard dog. And the guard dog, who is a Doberman Pinscher called Barney, was let to sort of run around, have a good sniff around, and got a bit overexcited and started savaging the teddy bears. So I think about 100 teddy bears, including Elvis Presley's, were in varying degrees of injury by the time Barney was restrained. So I appreciate the need for security, but it can occasionally go wrong. I'm sure nothing's quite happened like that at the V&A.
Not on my watch. But I'm sure if we go back into the history, we'll find examples. There's all sorts of things that could go wrong. We had, coming out of COVID, we had this, and again, bear in mind that this was an exhibition planned years and years in advance. We did Fabergé. Now, I was skeptical about having an exhibition about incredibly valuable pieces of art, of decorative arts, celebrating ostentatious wealth. Is that what we really need coming out of COVID? And it turned out, yes, that's exactly what the country wanted coming out of COVID.
It was a real breath of fresh air, that. It was incredibly beautiful.
But what we couldn't predict, well, so we had, in the end room, I think we had about a dozen eggs, half of which came from the Kremlin. Now, we couldn't have predicted, well, perhaps we could have if we worked really hard, we couldn't have predicted that the tanks were going to roll into the Ukraine as the exhibition was happening. And then we had this question about, what do we do? What do we do with these Russian government-owned objects? And what the answer was, actually, was no problem at all, because I think to this day, the Russian government isn't sanctioned. So the Russian-owned objects, the objects owned by the government, were able to get back. Oligarch-owned objects is a different question. And all of the museums, when this was happening, we all looked very closely. What have we got in Russia? And what have they got here? And it, actually, interestingly, there was a balance of what the stuff we had of theirs and the stuff they had of ours. And then there was a bit of a rush. We had, I don't think we had anything at the V&A in Russia, but some of the other museums did have stuff in Russia. But there was an interesting rush on both sides to just get that stuff back. So we rushed to get the Russian stuff back. They rushed. And this was involved curators jumping on planes to Helsinki and then chartering vans to get themselves over the border to get stuff back. But that was happening. So there's geopolitical risks. I mean, interesting, funny enough, recently, I would say this, wouldn't I? But I think there's been an unfair focus on mistakes that museums make in an exhibition. So the British Museum had a wonderful exhibition on 19th century China, but they made a mistake. They didn't clear the copyright in some translations and they got savaged. It was a copyright infringement. It was fair enough. It was a copyright infringement, but they got savaged online. There was a pile-on. And what was a wonderful exhibition, beautifully curated with a mistake, ended up, all the focus was on the mistake rather than anything else. And we had, you know, and I had great sympathy for the curators in that exhibition who I know. And we had something similar where we misattributed a quote in one of our exhibitions. And again, huge pile on social media. So there's reputational risk of getting things wrong. In a way, it's heartening because what it indicates to me is that museums are trusted in a way that no other institutions are. Newspapers can say all sorts of things. University lecturers can say all sorts of things. If a museum gets something wrong, there's a pylon. And in a way, it's encouraging because I think it indicates that the public expect more of us. They really expect us to do it absolutely perfectly. If we don't, we're in trouble.
It's the last word, isn't it?
Yeah. It shows the authority which you've got in terms of presenting design, art, history, whatever it is, that sometimes it's sort of the badly expressed comment about a historical figure is capable of ricocheting around because it's a museum which has put that label up or whoever, whereas most of the people saying that sort of thing simply wouldn't get noticed. But it does, in a sense, it shows the strength of the museums that people, as Clarissa said, I expect it to be authoritative and good.
Authority is absolutely the word. I think even in my world of tax and heritage, there are some myths about what can happen if a museum displays your object and what that means about the object and the kind of new status it confers on the object, which the object's exactly the same. It hasn't changed at all. But the perception is often that if it has been exhibited at a serious museum, then that sort of somehow changes it. So yeah, absolutely. It's a lot of responsibility, isn't it?
Great responsibility, but also there's, as with everything, there's benefits. So you're right, Clarissa, that having some museum exhibitions in your provenance will help with value as well. But it's not just objects, it's our suppliers too. So if you're an architect and you've got a museum or two under your belt, then that's a huge kudos to you. So that means that when we say we need a new wing on a museum or we need to refit one of our galleries, we know we're going to get some fantastic architects pitching for that work at competitive prices because who doesn't want to have their name associated with, and it's not just us, it's the Tate, the British Museum, the National Gallery. Everybody wants to have their name associated with the big museums.
Of course, it's all the glamour of the art world, but none of the filthy lucre of the commercial art world. So it's absolutely perfect as a brand. So we haven't yet mentioned Taylor Swift. And at the moment, there is, of course, the objects tour. So what I wanted to ask you about that was, again, it's going back to the museum's objects. Is this bringing in a whole new raft of people to the museum?
Yes. So this is a little game that we're playing at the moment. So again, I get involved very early. So I got very early on in these proceedings when we were talking about this as a possibility. I was asked to look at the most brutal NDA that I had ever seen. So that was the first interaction with the Taylor Swift team. But actually thereafter, they were wonderful to work with. They were very professional, very slick outfit. So we were locked down on confidentiality. And then we negotiated the loans of a dozen or so objects. But they were very commercial, very sensible. And we thought, well, what do we do? We could have like a discreet little bit of the museum tucked away and get all the Swifties in there. But we thought cynically, no, what we'll do is we will scatter these objects around with the hope that we can get, because of course there will be Swifties who come to other museum exhibitions, but a large proportion of them, the V&A will be new to them. So what we've done is we've scattered those objects throughout the museum, and it's called the Taylor Swift Songbook Trail. So you can get a handout as you walk in the door, and we drag these poor Swifties through the European galleries, the British galleries, bit of ceramics, bit of metalwork. If you're going to do that, you can do that. I would wear a pair of soft shoes, not your rhinestone cowboy boots. Wear a pair of sneakers to do that exhibition because you're going to be doing a lot of walking. But it's been very successful.
It's the Sistine Chapel approach. I went to Rome a few weeks ago with my son and we wanted to see the Sistine Chapel. And oh my goodness, the amount of art we saw on the way to the Sistine Chapel. We were both absolutely dead on our feet by the time we got there. But luckily it was so transporting when we did finally arrive. And I hope the same is true of the Taylor Swift songbook tour. I don't doubt it.
Yes, well, I asked one Swiftie at breakfast this morning who thought it was, quote, really cool. her take on the sort of the website description of it. And I see it's sort of gone down very well. Has the V&A been packed out this week?
I'll find out next week when we have our sort of catch up of what the figures are. But I imagine it's done well. It's always quite interesting to see the vibe around the museum where we have particular exhibitions on. We had a great exhibition on South Korea, contemporary culture and historical culture. And again, we got the zeitgeist. We hit that on the nose as well. This is post-Parasite, post-Squid Game. Only just post-Squid Game, really. And of course, K-pop. But the museum was just full of these like incredible fashionistas wandering around with outrageous clothes on, which was a departure from what we had before. Whereas when we had Pink Floyd, we had lots of middle-aged men wearing band t-shirts, which was, again, made for a less aesthetically pleasing environment to walk around. But still, it was a nice way to change our demographic.
At the beginning of this conversation, you said that you'd love to be more involved in deciding what wins and what loses in terms of exhibition ideas. And so I think what I always ask myself is, what would I put on? So what would you, if the V&A exhibition fairy granted you a single wish, what exhibition would you mount at the V&A?
Well, it would never happen because we don't need this demographic. It would be similar to the Pink Floyd demographic, actually, which is because I've got a soft spot for 70s prog rock.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I would like to have a 70s prog rock exhibition, but I don't think that the world needs more King Crimson, Yes, and early Genesis fans wandering around South Kensington. I think there'd be uproar.
Richard and I would come to your exhibition, yeah. Anthony.
I bet you wouldn't. I bet you'd have a strange uncle who would come along who'd love it.
Well, if only there were such a thing as the exhibition fairies. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. What an absolutely brilliant discussion. And it's been absolutely fascinating. And my fingers are crossed for the prog rock exhibition one day.
Andy, thank you very much for coming and talking to us. And we'll get a chance to enjoy the Taylor Swift exhibition.
Great. And Naomi and tropical modernism.
Indeed.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Thanks, Carissa. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you for listening to the Art and Heritage Law Contested Heritage. Please do follow or subscribe on Apple or Spotify podcasts to enjoy more shows.
We have a new podcast out every fortnight. If you're able, please take the time to rate us and put down a review.
The show is also on the 39 Essex Chambers website, along with podcast series on topics such as artificial intelligence, climate change, and planning.